Well, several years ago, Randy Harris was preparing to teach to his freshman Bible majors this very passage we're going to look at this morning about anger and about contempt and about murder. And he'd taught it for several years, and he assumed that being freshman Bible majors, students who wanted to go into ministry, they'd probably read it for several years. So he was trying to think of a creative way to teach this lesson so that they would remember it and so they would engage it. And he decided he wanted to try and pull a prank on his class. And he got there early that morning, and there was one student that was sitting there, and he walked up to him and he said, "Can you act?" And the student said, "You mean like theater acting?" And he said, "Yeah, like theater act." And he said, "Well, no, not really." And he said, "Well, here's what I was hoping you and I might do together. I was hoping we might be able to convince the class that we are so angry with one another, we're about to start throwing punches." And he thought to himself for a second and said, "I think I could do that." And so he said, "Okay, this is what I want you to do. I'm going to give my normal speech at the first of class, and I'm going to ask everybody to turn off their cell phones. And I want you about 5 minutes later to make your cell phone go off. And then I'm going to say some harsh things to you, and I want you to say some things back to me. And let's try to get these kiddos to think that we're about to have an altercation, a confrontation there." And he said, "You think that'll work?" And Randy said, "Well, as long as you don't overact, I think it will work." So he did his normal speech, and he talked about how he'd really appreciate it if they would turn off their cell phones. And 5 minutes later, this student makes his cell phone go off, and Randy starts belaboring the point again, and he looks at this student, and there were some nervous chuckles from the other students around him, and he just said, "What is wrong with you? Why can't you understand what I've just said? Those were all one-syllable words. What didn't you get about turn your cell phone off? Even for an athlete, you ought to be able to grasp that concept." He said the student, he was perfect, and he just leaned back in his chair and crossed his arms, and he said, "What is your problem?" Randy said, "Well, right now you are." And the student said, "Well, I can solve that for you." And he packed up his stuff, and he began walking up towards the exit. And Randy said, "The next step you take better be towards me." And the student turned around, and they began walking towards one another, and they get nose to nose. And he said, "You could have heard a pin drop in that classroom." And Randy looked at everybody and said, "Gotcha!" And they didn't laugh. They didn't find that funny at all. And Randy actually says, to this day, there's a couple of foreign exchange students that still have no idea what took place. "I thought about starting my sermon by trying to do something similar here, but I didn't think you'd find the humor in it either. I was going to have an altercation with Glenn Cannon or somebody, you know, and see if we couldn't convince you we were about to have a fight or something." I think Glenn would have been on board with that. Randy asked his class, after a few minutes of letting them digest what occurred, he asked them, what have I done? What have you known about me in the last 6 to 7 weeks that would make you think that was real? That I would actually instigate a fight with a fellow student? What in the world would make you think that we were actually about to come to blows there?" And they thought, and Randy answered the question for him. He said, "Here's the answer. It's because the whole world is crazy. It's because we see this occur day in and day out, regardless of whether or not we're Christian. We see people interact all the time, and something small becomes something big in a hurry, and people get in fights all of the time. Be it physical altercation, be it slurred words, some arguments take place all throughout the day. We see this everywhere we look in our world. In fact, in the United States alone, this year there will be 25,000 murders. And 1,000 of those murders will occur in the workplace. And in fact, over 1 million people will be injured in the workplace by a coworker instigating some sort of violence. That's just in the United States alone, and that's just in the workplace. And I think we all know that that type of angry atmosphere, that type of angry disposition doesn't just stay in the workplace, does it? You have a bad day like that at the workplace, we tend to bring it home to our spouses and to our children and to my little Pomeranian annoying dog named Peanut. We live in an angry culture. In fact, most of us probably carry around a great supply of anger with us. That's why things like road rage occur, right? It's not just that that person cut us off in traffic, or it's not just that that person said that one condescending remark to us. Usually we have a whole supply of anger that we can then unleash when that one incident sets us off. Anger is an epidemic in our culture. It's everywhere. And that's why the words of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount are so pertinent to not only His day and His time and His place, but to ours as well. Look at what Jesus has to say in Matthew chapter 5, beginning in the 21st verse this morning. He says, "You've heard that it was said to the people long ago, you shall not murder. And anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to a brother or sister, 'Raca,' is answerable to the court. And anyone who says, 'You fool,' will be in danger of the fire of hell. Therefore, if you're offering your gift at the altar and there remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First, go and be reconciled to them. Then come and you can offer your gift. Settle matters quickly with your adversary who's taking you to court. Do it while you are still together on the way, or your adversary may hand you over to the judge. The judge may hand you over to the officer and you may be thrown into prison. Truly, I tell you, you will not get out until you have paid the last penny." So Jesus begins these six teachings in Matthew chapter 5 that we really introduced last week, talking about what Jesus is after and what He means and what's at the heart of what He's saying when He says that your righteousness should surpass that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. And one of the things we talked about last week is that Jesus is saying it's great to carry out the external rituals of the law, but if your heart is not righteous on the inside, if it's not followed by an inward disposition, if it's not followed by a transformed spirituality from within, it's all for nothing. And Jesus begins the first of these six teachings by talking about an epidemic not only in His day, but ours as well. See, most of us read the words of Jesus about "you shall not murder," which are actually the words of Moses, the Ten Commandments, part of those that were given to the people of Israel. And we feel pretty good about ourselves, most of us. Like, I haven't killed anybody today. I haven't even really considered killing anybody today. Or we read the words about you shouldn't say to your brother or your sister, "Raca." And I think to myself, I haven't said any "Raca" to anybody in a while. In fact, I haven't even called anybody a fool for a long time. We feel pretty good about ourselves. And yet Jesus takes it deeper. He says there's more to it than simply not killing somebody. There's more to it than simply avoiding some words and some slurs and some derogatory terms. It has to do with one's heart. What's going on the inside? In 2008, there was a book released written by Robert Bolaño. The book was simply entitled 2666. It's a long book. It's like 900 pages. And mostly it's a true story. It tells the tale of some horrific murders and rapes and the torturing of some young women down below the border in Mexico. Based on true events, and the crime wasn't solved for over 20 years. But at one point in the story, there's some detectives who are working the case, and they're sitting and they're processing together. They're at a bar and they're talking about things, and they begin telling what, for lack of a better term, we would describe as something like blonde jokes. And they're making fun of women. And what's really interesting about what Bolaño, the writer, is doing there is I think he's trying to make a connection. And I think what he's trying to say is that these jokes, these derogatory jokes about women, that they have something to do with these murders. That they're more closely related than you and I may care to admit. Of course, murder is worse, but I think what Bolaño may be saying is they're kind of related. They're along the same lines. And that may be what Jesus is doing as well, in saying that when you are angry with a brother or a sister, you may think that murdering them is way, way off in the distance. Something you would never do. And yet Jesus is trying to say they have something to do with one another. Most of the time, anger can be murder waiting in the hatch. Most murders don't occur without some sort of anger or contempt in one's heart, and he's trying to connect the two. So he begins talking about our anger and our contempt, and especially the way that we speak to one another. You know, that term raka was like calling someone in our day an idiot or a twerp or something like that. And it wouldn't be all that offensive, but it's a way of putting someone down. It's a way of expressing contempt toward another. And it's a common practice today if you listen to people talk, especially among men. We like to show that we like somebody by putting them down and making fun of them. That's our way. We're strange like that. But to call somebody a fool, which doesn't mean much to us, was much more than that in Jesus' day. It's not only to express contempt toward another person, but it's to harbor malice in one's heart toward that person. To think of an equivalent term in our day, in our time, I'd simply just say, think of the most heinous, offensive name you could call or be called by someone. And in Jesus' day, that name would be fool. It's not to view them as a person who has very low intelligence or who isn't worth much. It's to not view them as a person at all. Someone who's not even made in the image of God. Someone who's not even worthy of our time or our compassion or our care. I like the way that Dallas Willard observes upon our culture, especially as generation after generation is born. He says, recent cultural observers have noted the overwhelming rise in the use of filthy language, especially among our young people. Curiously, few have been able to find any grounds for condemning it other than personal taste. How strange. Can it be that they actually find contempt acceptable? Or are they unable to recognize it? Filthy language and name-calling are always an expression of contempt. And the current swarm of filthy language floats upon the sea of contempt in which our society is now adrift. In fact, some attention has recently been paid to 12 or 14-year-old children who kill people for no apparent reason. And commentators have remarked on the lack of feeling in these young killers. But when you observe them accurately, you will see that they are indeed actuated by feeling. Watch their faces. It is contempt. They are richly contemptuous of others, and at the same time terrified or enraged at being dissed, which in their language is contempt. I think he's on to something there in saying that contempt and malice in one's heart toward another quickly leads down a road that we wouldn't think it would. That anger and contempt in one's heart can quickly get out of control. And it's something we have to pay attention to. And I think he's on to something too, Jesus, when he talks about the language that we use and how we speak to and about one another. We're fond of labels. We love to label somebody and put them in categories. And when we do that, we end up summarizing the totality of that person into that category. Oh, he's a liberal. She's a conservative. Oh, he's a homosexual, as if that only constitutes their being. Their sexuality is all that matters. Oh, that person is it's one of those folks. That person is one of them. And labels become a way of dehumanizing another and expressing our contempt for their very existence. And Jesus says, be very careful how you speak to one another. And even if you're not saying them, be careful what you think about them. Because our language and our anger and our contempt, they reveal a lot about what's going on in our hearts. And they reveal a lot about what we're passionate about, sometimes for better and sometimes for worse. And so Jesus says, be very careful with your anger. Now, I don't think here he's saying that you are never to be angry. Even Jesus gets angry in his ministry at times. In Mark chapter 3, he gets frustrated with the religious leaders after he's trying to heal somebody. In John chapter 2, you'll remember that he runs the people out of the temple who are selling things like it's a marketplace, and he calls them a den of robbers, quoting Jeremiah. Jesus even gets angry at times. And there are some things that rightly should upset us. There are some things that we should not be happy about. But righteous anger is a burning desire to see the world made right. And that's not what Jesus is talking about here. The warning that Jesus gives isn't about that. And also saying that sometimes anger is warranted or justified isn't an excuse to harbor it or to cultivate it. Jesus' instructions here are very telling. I want you to notice Jesus' solution to the problem here. What he's saying is there's a lot of ways of dealing with anger. And you and I are familiar with the first two. One way of dealing with anger is to express it, to just blow up at a situation. You ever been around somebody like that? They just tend to go off at the smallest little thing. I have a former brother-in-law who I was always afraid to go out to eat with because I never knew what this poor waiter or waitress was going to experience if they brought the wrong thing. Usually end up finding myself, you know, leaving some huge, massive tip trying to make up for what they had to go through. That's one way of expressing one's anger or dealing with one's anger. And then there's those of us that become passive-aggressive, right? We don't say anything. We stew in it. We like to harbor it inside and we like to think about it and go over it in our minds and turning it into something bigger. And maybe we'll release it at a later point. And Jesus says neither one of those ways is the way that you deal with anger. It's not by outburst and it's not by suppressing it. Jesus' solution is simple. The way you deal with anger is to seek reconciliation. That's what he says. If you have anger in your heart, what you should do is seek to be reconciled. And he says it's important to deal with not only at some point in the future, but immediately. That reconciliation and our relationships are actually connected to our relationship with God. How you deal in your relationships with one another directly impacts your relationship with God. Did you notice that? He says that if you're going to make a gift or a sacrifice at the altar in worship to God, and there you realize not only do I have something against another brother, maybe a brother or sister has something against me. What you should do is leave your gift there and go and be reconciled. He says, go immediately. Go quickly. And he says, go directly to that person. Don't go to your best friend and talk about it. If that young preacher says something you don't like, don't go to your favorite elder and tell him about it. You think that doesn't get to me? Talk to the person. Go and be reconciled to that person. Go and speak directly to them and go quickly. Jesus says it's that important. I like the way that Paul says it in Ephesians chapter 4 in verse 26 and 27. He doesn't say don't be angry. He just says this, in your anger, do not sin. Do not let the sun go down while you're still angry, and don't give the devil a foothold. Some of you, maybe you've golfed a time or two, and you may know what it is to make a divot. If you don't, come golf with me sometime and I will show you. When you make a divot, it's when you swing your club trying to hit the ball and you end up getting a lot more of the ground than you do of the ball. And a big hunk of grass and dirt comes flying out of the ground. Big piece of turf. Now, if you leave that hunk of grass there for a week or so, and then you come back and try and put it back in the ground, it won't take. It will be dead. There's nothing you can do. But if you'll replace that hunk of grass, if you'll take it and put it right back where it was immediately, it's amazing how that grass will stay alive, how it will begin to grow together again with all that's around it. And that's what Jesus says relationships are like. That's what he says our wounds between ourselves and with others are like. He says, don't push it off until a later time. Don't push it off even until after worship. Go now. Don't wait until you're in a courtroom with somebody. Don't let the justice system work it out for you. You take charge. You go, and as long as it's up to you, you be reconciled with that person. The longer you wait to reconcile, the more difficult it can become. And maybe the greater threat is that the longer you wait to reconcile, the more the devil begins to lick his chops. That's what Paul's talking about in Ephesians chapter 4. Don't give the devil a chance to whittle his way in there and to separate you even farther. You remember what God said to Cain? Genesis chapter 4, you remember how that starts, don't you? Cain and his brother Abel both go and make an offering to God, and God looks favorably upon Abel's offering, but not so much upon Cain. And Cain is pretty upset about that. You remember the question that God asked him? Why are you so angry? Why are you so angry, Cain? And he gives him a stern warning and he says, sin is crouching at your door. It seeks to have you. And if you don't do something about it, well, some bad things may come of it. And you know the rest of the story, don't you? You know, sometimes I think we read that story and think Cain brought Abel out into the field premeditating that he would murder him. Maybe that's what happened. You might even be able to make the case, though, that he brought him out into the field to have an argument, and it escalated quickly. We're not told the details. What we are told is that Cain was harboring and cultivating anger and refused to seek amends. He refused to seek reconciliation. And Jesus doesn't want any more Cains. And he certainly doesn't want any more Abels with their blood crying out from the ground. So he says, drop what you're doing, pick up the phone, get in the car, and go and seek amends. And one of the things he says, actually, is that until you do that, it seems that he's saying, is that your worship to God is kind of pointless. I like the way that Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a Christian martyr, says it. He says, when a man gets angry with his brother, he's guilty of murder, and he forfeits his relation to God. He erects a barrier, not only between himself and his brother, but also between himself and God. He no longer has access to Him. His sacrifice, His worship, His prayer, they're not acceptable in His sight. If we despise our brother, our worship is unreal, and it forfeits every divine promise. When we come before God with hearts full of contempt and unreconciled with our neighbors, we are both individually and as a congregation worshiping an idol. He says you erect a barrier. You have this gap between you and God when you erect a barrier between a brother or a sister and you seek not to be reconciled. I used to minister at a congregation in which there literally were two brothers, blood brothers, that had gotten into a fight several years ago, a fist fight out in public, and everybody knew about it. And what was really interesting is they continued to go to and worship at the same congregation, but they never wanted to be in the same room together. It was amazing to me that week after week they would come to Bible classes and worship services and sit far apart from one another, not acknowledging one another's presence, not talking to one another, but thinking all along that this worship to God is somehow pleasing and acceptable in His sight. And we all knew it. None of us addressed it. It's amazing to me that we have this idea in our minds that somehow that's okay, that we can have a brother or sister who has something against us and we don't seek reconciliation, then we can come and worship before God and it's all right. Jesus says that's not the way it works. If you have a barrier between a brother or a sister and you yourself don't seek to make amends, you're erecting a barrier between you and between the God you claim to worship. So he says, go quickly, be reconciled, don't wait any longer. Jesus isn't saying, don't worry about murder so much. What he's saying is, look, the law has its purpose. And the law in saying, do not murder, isn't simply saying, try to get through your day without killing anybody. Jesus is trying to get us to the target, to the goal, to the point of the law. And it's wonderful if you can get through your day and say, I didn't kill anybody today. But that's not really the purpose of the law. You see, if you were flying somewhere or driving somewhere, maybe some of you had friends or family come in for Summit last week. Maybe they flew into Abilene. And it would be an odd statement, wouldn't it, if they were to come in and say something like, man, I'm glad I didn't end up in L.A. or glad I didn't end up in New York. As if that's how you get to Abilene, right? By trying not to go to L.A. or trying not to go to New York. You never arrive at the destination you're looking for if you're simply trying not to go somewhere else. You have to have a target. You have to have a goal, something you are pursuing. And it's wonderful to say, I'm trying not to kill anybody. Jesus says that's not how you get to the place where the law intends, though. You have to pursue what the law is after. And what the law is after is not simply not killing somebody. It's not simply not even being angry. It's not simply don't call them names, don't label them, don't use derogatory terms. What the law is after is reconciliation. That's our goal. Our goal is to seek reconciliation with our brothers and our sisters around us. That's what we're aiming for. That's what we're shooting at. And anger so often stands in the way. I don't know if this is something you really struggle with, something you deal with. Even if it's not, my guess is there are some people who are pretty close to you that do. I wonder what it would look like for us to be the least angry people in the world. You know, we don't exactly have that reputation, us Christians. In fact, many people who are non-believers, they look at Christians and they see us fight and they see us bicker and they see us lose our temper just as much as anybody else. And I'm wondering what it would look like if we committed to being not just the least angry people in the world, but the people who pursue reconciliation the most. What would that look like? And I got to tell you, I think one of the reasons we're so angry is because we continue to allow our culture to feed us an angry disposition. You know what I mean? Watch our television shows. Watch the news. Watch the sports news even. And they love to set up one anchor against another and watch them debate and argue and fight and say, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. This is what you should think. And watch them bicker back and forth. I'm wondering what it would look like if occasionally we turned off the news. And if rather than reading the headlines, we began, I don't know, maybe to read our Bibles a little bit. What if we turned off talk radio every once in a while? Have you ever listened to the way people talk on talk radio? And I don't care what perspective you are in the political spectrum. You ever listen to the way people talk on talk radio? Have you ever noticed you can get in your car and listen to talk radio and get out 5 minutes later and be angry? And you were having a good day? It's amazing the way that anger is fed to us and the way that we just consume it. I'm wondering what it would look like to pursue the Jesus way instead of the way of the world. I'm wondering what it would look like if we were the least angry people the world knew and the people who most sought reconciliation in our relationships. And I want to take the words of Jesus seriously this morning and say this is important enough that you don't need to wait to do this. In a room this size, my guess is there's probably somebody in here that either you have something against or they have something against you. I'm wondering if what would it look like if right now we sought reconciliation. So in just a moment, I'm going to offer an invitation. And maybe you'll want to come down front where we have some shepherds and maybe you'll want to pray with them. Maybe you'll want to go in the back in the foyer where there'll be a couple of shepherds back there and you'll want to pray with them about it. Or maybe you'll want to fill out one of those prayer request cards on the back of the pew in front of you and turn that in so the elders can pray about that. Or maybe, just maybe, you'll want to go directly to an individual that's sitting here in this place. You know, one of the most beautiful stories I've ever heard is a story that took place over in Kenya. Jack Reese, who used to be the dean of the Bible College here at ACU, he went over to Kenya one year and he was going to the worship service, and when it came time for communion, he thought they practiced it in a rather odd way. And the way it would work is one family would go up and they would take communion and they would look across the gathered group of people and they would find another family and they would say, "Let's take communion together." And he thought that was interesting, but what he found out is in a lot of those stories, the reason one family would pick out another family is because they had ill will towards one another. Oftentimes, one leader of one tribe or one group or one family would have had some sort of altercation or some sort of marred past in which they had ill will and ill feelings toward one another. And that time around the table, they sought to be reconciled. That the broken body of Jesus would bring about peace and reconciliation in the body of Christ, the church. I would love for that to be what we're known for. I would love for that to be the picture of what we're doing in communion. Not just my sins are washed away so that my relationship with God is restored, but my relationship with my brothers and my sisters is restored as well. I'm going to offer an invitation. If you have a need this morning, if this is something you're battling with and dealing with, and let's make no joke about it, we all are. If this is something that is plaguing you and is heavy on your heart, seek to be reconciled this morning. If there's something that these shepherds that will be in these various places I mentioned can do to pray over you, they'll be glad to do that. But if there's somebody in this place, go to them now. Don't wait. Skip Bible class. It's okay. Go and be reconciled with your brothers and sisters this morning. If you have a need, won't you come while we stand and while we sing?